You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, we head to the North Woods of the USA in the company of our good friend, Chad Lewis, on the hunt for some unusual creatures. In Chad's latest book, Lumberjack Creatures of the North Woods, we meet some strange and dangerous creatures lurking behind every tree. We meet the jackalope, a cute creature attracted by the songs of working lumberjacks, the docile yet lovable hoogag, a no-need gentle giant, the vicious man-eating hide-behind, which was the scourge of lonely lumberjacks, alongside the famous hodag, a fearsome creature that made newspaper headlines across America towards the end of the 19th century. It's always good to catch up with Chad and take a trip into the American folklore that many of us may not be aware of. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support the show on Patreon by clicking on the link in the show notes or going to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters to sign up for $4 a month for early releases, ad-free episodes, and much more besides. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find your Mysteries and Monsters updates via our website at mysteriesandmonsters.com, where you'll find links and merchandise by using the tabs at the top of the page. As always, a big thank you to Dean Bestall for his artwork, Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys on production, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now to the woods, on the hunt for those creatures that kept many a lumberjack awake at night, with Mr. Chad Lewis. Something I've learned to reconnect with over the last couple of years is folklore from around the world. I think we can learn a lot about ourselves and our environment by the tales our ancestors told. In part, I've become fascinated by some of the strange creatures of American folklore and the weird creatures that the lumberjacks would talk about in the north of the United States. So who better to illuminate these strange and peculiar creatures than Mr. Chad Lewis? Chad, welcome, sir.
Greetings from the North Woods of Wisconsin.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great up here in the tall trees as October's casting its weather down. Tis the season.
Very much so. So are you planning your hibernation at the moment, Chad, or are you still hoping to venture out for a few weeks before the cold north winds come in?
Yes, I'm one of those rare creatures that I enjoy the winter months. And just because here in the U.S. and Wisconsin, you have no other choice but to enjoy it or suffer miserably for 4 months. So, yes.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose that is the benefit of embracing the winter in all its glory then, Chad.
And you really do. I love the change of seasons that, you know, I've spent a lot of time in warm climates in Florida, California and the like. And it's just day after day, you kind of lose that ability to appreciate the different seasons because it's always pleasant.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I've got some nice jumpers that I like to get out of the wardrobe, Chad. So I appreciate that point of view. And it's good to have a bit of a variety. Obviously, you don't want it too extreme in certain situations. But yeah, I think variety is the spice of life. And that certainly applies to the weather as well.
I agree. There's nothing better than doing a warm vacation spot in the middle of the winter to break it up. You appreciate the warmth. And then when you get back, you appreciate the rest of winter.
Yeah, very much so. And it's always nice to come home to a roasting fire and homely comforts, I think, after a nice break.
It really does. The best thing about travel is it allows you to appreciate your home base.
I mean, I'm just very glad, Chad, because I've noticed that as things have wound their way into spooky season over the late summer months and early autumnal period, you've been
wandering around, and I'm delighted to see that you survived the Windigo Festival.
This was my first year there. My colleague and co-author of the Windigo book, Kevin Nelson, and I were there. And it was more of a celebration of Halloween and horror than it was paranormal. But there was still some crossover. Kevin and I spoke there. But it was really cool because a lot of people were dressed up in costumes and, you know, horror-based. And it was just creepy, half of which I didn't even recognize because they were so specific of a character. But of course you had Texas Chainsaw Massacre type people, Freddy, Jason, even people dressed as Ed Gein walking around the fairground. So that was pretty eye-opening.
So how long's this Wendigo Festival been running? Is it a fairly recent addition to the cryptid calendar?
Well, I think it's their fifth year, and although they call it Windigo Festival, until this year when Kevin and I spoke, there wasn't much Windigo-based stuff going on. They just chose that name because they thought it really embraced the Halloween spirit, the horror aspect of it all, and could provide a big umbrella for all these other groups to come and meet. So they have stuff like bands there. They have costume contests and all sorts of oddities from vendors that are just a little weird, or some might consider them macabre.
Yeah. So how's it been developing then? Is it something that kind of started off as a fairly low-key kind of celebration of all things horrific, Chad, and it's kind of grown as a lot of these things seem to be these days, that they really seem to be taking a life of their own? So with this one, has this kind of seen the same kind of growth? Obviously, it may have gone backwards a little bit because of the current situation with the pandemic, but in light of its growth from where it began, has it come a fair way?
It has, although it was gigantic when it started. As I said, my colleague Kevin Nelson was there the first year as a spectator, and he said there were thousands of people there in its first year, and it's gotten so big that they moved it from the downtown location out to a big fairgrounds area. And I think this year, as with last year, it was scaled back a bit with what's going on, but there were still thousands of people that showed up, and I think it really illustrates that people, especially in America, are looking for uniqueness, something odd and unusual to do, and they're willing to support it.
Yeah. Well, it certainly looked fantastic. So were you guys doing a lecture over the weekend? Did you have a couple of slots, or did you just have one performance that you were able to educate the people to make sure that they take care when they're out in the woods, Chad?
Yes, we had done a Saturday only. Unfortunately, October's pretty busy for us, so we were only there on Saturday, and we did a program. And it's amazing of how many people came up to us during the day we were there saying they never knew anything about the Windigo. Even though the festival was named after it, they just had no idea anything about the legend. So that's always fun when you get people that are experiencing it for the first time and take it in and really get a grip on how gruesome and weird and perplexing it is, that until then they had not known anything about it except that it was named after the festival.
Wow. I find that really interesting because I think often when we enjoy these subjects and these cryptids, we can sometimes presume that they're probably more well-known than they are. So did that surprise you a bit? Or were you not surprised in your experience that a lot of people, unless they are exposed to it or they've read about it, don't really seem to know that much about the history of this particular creature?
I think you said it perfectly, that those of us in this field that live and breathe it, we think, oh, everyone knows what the Jersey Devil is. Everybody's heard of the Chupacabra. How could you not? And then when you get in the real world where 90% of the rest of the world lives, you find that they have no idea about these legends. And I even found that when I started about 25 years ago, I started putting programs together, conferences in my hometown of Eau Claire. And at first, I would bring in, when I was a young kid, you know, I would bring in what I thought were big names in the field to give a lecture. And then I'd have some local people talking about local stuff as well. And what I found is that to the general public, there are no big names in the field. They were more interested in the topic than the actual presenter, which I found fascinating. Now, today that's changed a little bit with a lot of TV shows and TV celebrities of paranormal fame. You know, that's a little bit, but it still rings true that people love the topic more so than the person, because again, 90% of the country's not ever going to have heard of anybody in this field.
Well, I think that makes us even more special then.
I do too. And it's always interesting when you're not preaching to the choir, when you're giving lectures and programs to people who really have never heard of any of this. It's a lot of fun because they're soaking it all in versus somebody who might know a lot of these stories already. And you can just have a little more fun with it, I think.
Yeah. Leading them astray, I suspect.
Yes, exactly.
And the other festival that I often look for, due to your connection primarily with it, is the Van Meter one. And that's another one that seems to be really sort of growing, because I know when we did an episode about this wonderful cryptid a few months ago, I had a lot of people who, once again, Chad, as we said earlier, I was really surprised because I love this story. And obviously your book with Kevin and covering all the events of everything that went on 100 years ago back there, that in that week of strangeness, it's another one that seems to really, really started to have developed. I think, as we were saying there, my knowledge of the creature has certainly increased a great deal, primarily through reading your work and listening to your other interviews and lectures on this particular thing. But have you seen that creature kind of come around again and people really connecting with it?
I believe because it's so strange that you have this giant 8-foot bat-like creature that had a horn on its head, it could project light and erase memories, that it's so bizarre that that's what's driving the interest in it. It's unlike almost anything else out there.
Mm.
So I think when today we're flooded with a lot of Bigfoot stories, which I love, but sometimes they can kind of run together, much like UFO sightings tend to do.
Hmm.
Where it's just a ball of light disappears. Still fascinating, but yet, so now all of a sudden you throw this giant 8-foot bat-like creature and people stand back and say, wait a minute, I want to know more about that.
Yeah. So how's the town? Is the town continuing to embrace this crazy cryptid in regards to its history and embrace the festival as well?
They are. And I think a lot of them, whether the town's only about 900 people, so it's not a big area. And I think a lot of people, even if they don't believe the old legend, they love the idea of it. They love that it's their town's weird history, whether, again, they believe it or not, they still have fun with it. And I think that's the important part, that you can celebrate this folklore, these legends, without actually having to believe it 100%. So I think a lot of them are seeing it as a fun way to celebrate their local history.
Yeah. So how was the tour of the sites of the action, Chad? How did that go down? Because that's one of the highlights when I look at that itinerary. I think, well, if I'm lucky enough to ever get out there, that's certainly going to be something I want to do. I want to be boots on the ground, having a look at the areas that this creature allegedly arrived upon and terrified the townsfolk.
That's my favorite part as well. And as I mentioned, because it's such a small town, if anything, it has shrunk over the last 100 years, where all the buildings are still there, where they shot at it, where they tried to capture it. And it's all within walking distance, you know, 3-4 blocks, where you can go there and see where the bank manager shot out the front window of the bank. The vault is still there. You can go in it and peek around, and that you don't need a great imagination to view yourself literally following in the footsteps of those people of 1903. So that's my favorite part, because you really have that opportunity that is just not present at a lot of other legends.
Yeah, I suppose that is one of the benefits, because it's enclosed in such a small area. I suppose that is quite exciting to know that you can literally touch base on every aspect of that story and sort of drink it in.
You can walk right out at the end of the tour. We go out to the old brick and tile factory where it was spotted by this old abandoned mine.
Mm.
And what's so fascinating is people on the tour just reach down in the soil and grab a chunk of brick from that brick factory.
Yeah.
I mean, you could see that if it's the same brick, you could have thrown that brick in 1903 at the monster had you wanted to, and it's still there right at your feet.
Yeah, so people were taking mementos, were they?
Yeah, people, and I think the farmer who owns the land now is grateful because it's cleaning up all the debris from the area. So that person might just want more and more tours there.
I didn't think of it like that. That's a good point, Chad. Yeah.
You know, it's like all of the farm B&Bs that are popular now where you pay to go live on the farm and do the chores.
Oh, really?
Here in America, a lot of farms open up and they'll let you stay there, and then they'll come and you get to go feed the animals. You get to do the work of the farm and you pay them for that privilege.
Hey, that sounds like a good deal for the farmers.
Brilliant. I think it's a great idea for them.
Oh, fantastic. Well, what an original idea. That's certainly something. I'll see if there's anything like that over here in the UK. That's certainly a unique break, isn't it? Mixes it up.
It really is, and it's showcasing how farmers in America are changing. Where here in the U.S., I don't know if it's where you are, Paul, but here many farmers convert their farm during October in the fall to a fall festival where they'll have haunted hay rides and pumpkin patches and food and all kinds of games and rides and haunted hay rides and the like. And when I talk to a lot of them, they tell me that they make more doing that than they do farming.
Wow.
That they grow the corn just to make a corn maze out of it.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a lot of places around here now that have certainly embraced Halloween, because obviously it's something that's really grown this side of the pond over the last 30 years. And I've noticed more and more farms are doing sort of spooky mazes and Halloween ghost trails and things like that. And a lot of the stately homes do it as well these days, where you can, anytime through October, you can come along and go for a ghostly trip around the building and in the grounds and everything. But yeah, that's certainly something that I think that it's not as far on as it is in the States, but it's certainly a developing field here in the UK.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's great.
So as I touched on in our introduction, your latest book is one of those fabulous situations in this field, Chad, when I come across a book that I know next to nothing about a certain topic, and there are certain aspects of American folklore that I'm completely alien to. I've very little knowledge about the certain subjects. And lumberjacks is obviously something that seems to be very unique to the northern parts of the US and Canada, primarily because of the forestry and the work that was going on in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And as I said when we were chatting before we started the interview, I had no idea who Paul Bunyan was till about 10 years ago. And I kind of stumbled across who and what Paul Bunyan represents in American folklore in the modern era due to the Muffler Men, Chad, which was something else that I wasn't really aware of. And then I watched a documentary about someone doing a road trip down Route 66. And obviously there are several on there, which is a whole kind of weird and wonderful tour if you can decide to follow that route and look out for these incredibly large statues that seem to be dotted all over certain areas of the US, which I find some of them incredible. So for anybody like me who is completely naive about Paul Bunyan and his legacy, who is this chap and why does he have such a reputation in modern folklore, Chad?
Well, I think a lot of people around the world have trouble with our legends of lumberjacks and the lifestyle it was, because in America, one, we're a pretty big country, and we have such a vast amount of forest land. And this was especially true in the 17, 18 and early 1900s, that just thousands and millions of acres of untouched forest and forestry out there. And Paul Bunyan really grew from the lumber camps that a lot of people just have forgotten, that back during that era, tens of thousands of men from the mostly Midwest and East Coast would head up into the North Woods, where they would stay at the lumber camps all winter long, logging, and then they'd come home to their families in the spring with a bunch of money to try to save the farm or buy new livestock or buy more land to make the family farm profitable. And that idea that so many people would just leave for months on end really became forgotten in history, even here in the U.S. And it was during those lumber camps that Paul Bunyan began to spread the tales of Paul as this larger than life lumberjack who could do everything. He was bigger than anybody, stronger, smarter, more clever, everything. And unfortunately, the earliest tales of Paul Bunyan were lost, because when researchers and anthropologists and folklorists showed up to these lumber camps and recorded these stories, they found that many of them were sexist, racist, and just obscene, where they couldn't print them in the newspaper. They would have been arrested.
Yeah.
So a lot of the new Paul Bunyan stories are from the 1900s and beyond.
Mm. That is interesting that he seems to have developed and been kind of adapted to a changing climate then, Chad, in regards to that, because I wasn't aware of just how prevalent it is, because it seems that most of the northern US states have a connection or a story or some kind of tall tale that involves Paul Bunyan and his menagerie of wonderful pets.
If you believe the legend of Paul Bunyan, we have many states, my home state of Wisconsin, Maine, Michigan, Vermont, even California, all claim to be the home of Paul Bunyan. And that's excluding Canada, which also claims to be the home of Paul Bunyan. But what we do know is that the earliest oral tales of Paul seem to have originated in a lumber camp in northern Wisconsin during the winter of about 1885 and 1886. But it wasn't until 1904 that the first newspaper story about Paul Bunyan began, and that was printed in a Minnesota newspaper. And that was the, you know, two, three decades after people had been talking about it already. So that's unheard of today for a legend to be spreading orally for 30 years before somebody puts it in print. That's just unheard of.
Yeah, especially in the modern era as well, and the appetite for tall tales that a lot of newspapers at that time had, you would think he would be a prime candidate for such coverage at that period.
And Paul's much different in the early days than he is portrayed today, where we think of him as the strong, sturdy lumberjack, heavily muscled, wasn't afraid of anything, clean cut, handsome, you know, your intelligent brute, if you will. But in the early days, and even dating back to the early 1900s, when the newspapers did start printing these stories, he looked more like a wild caveman, like a primitive monster of the woods, part Sasquatch, part human coming out than he does today. And then in the 20s and 30s and 40s, he took on a more round appearance, like he was your plump uncle that was good at telling stories. And they used that image to sell pine and to sell lumber at the lumber yards, where he took on more of your, you know, cuddly uncle look.
I must admit, when I was reading some of the tales that are attributed to Paul, he's one of those characters where you just have to smile, because some of them are just fantastical. And the one that made me laugh the most is this one about him putting pieces of meat on his feet and skating on a grill because it was so long to to feed the rest of the lumberjacks.
Yes, the griddle was so big they'd have to skate on it with slabs of bacon or butter to grease the pan so they could make enough food for Paul. And that Paul and Babe are responsible for Minnesota's 10,000 lakes. Their footprints made all of the lakes, and that Paul was dragging his axe down and he created the Mississippi River. The same thing happened with the Grand Canyon, or that Paul and Babe are responsible for no trees being in North Dakota and South Dakota because they logged it completely free. So in America, we have all these tall tales about how Paul really formed a lot of what we think of as Americana.
Yeah, Yeah, it's very interesting. And I suppose it's quite surprising as well that in modern folklore, Chad, it's quite unusual for so many places to try and claim something like this. Obviously, we have something similar here between Nottinghamshire and Yorkshire in regards to Robin Hood. But I can't think of anything else in the US that seems to be so debated on about which state is his home state.
Not only his home state, but his death state.
Mm.
And of course, we all know that the death of Paul and Babe is the biggest yarn of them all, that Paul and Babe will never die. But people fight over where he's buried, this fictional character. And not only do they debate over where and the origin of him, but who has the best roadside attractions of him. As you were mentioning earlier, the Route 66, these large roadside attractions in America, there are probably more Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox related attractions than any other specific category in the entire country here.
I think one of the strangest stories, which quite nicely leads on from Paul, is obviously Paul's dog. Now, this is a very odd story, primarily because what happens to the dog to cause it to become such a legendary part of these stories?
Paul wasn't alone. Most people think of Paul Bunyan living on his own. Maybe Babe the Blue Ox is there as well. But Paul had a wide assortment of creatures and people around him, one of which was Sport, his dog. And it was said that when Sport came into the lumber camp, he was so small that at night Paul thought he was a mouse or a rat and threw his axe at the dog and cut him in half. And it wasn't until he went over and saw his mistake that he realized that Sport was a dog. So Paul hastily sewed him together, wrapped him in bandages, and nursed him back to health. And when he nursed him back to health, he undid the bandages and realized that in his hurriedness, he had attached the back legs facing up toward the sky instead of facing the ground. So now Sport's front paws were normal, but his back paws were facing up toward the sky. But this turned out to be a blessing in disguise because it was said that Sport could track down any animal it was hunting because Sport would run on his front legs until he got tired. Then he'd simply flip over and run on his back legs and keep flipping back and forth, meaning he never got tired.
It's fabulous. It's such a wild story, but it's fantastic that it seems so popular, because that's the one thing about a lot of these stories, Chad, is that they are fantastic and they are quite outlandish. And there's obviously a lot of leg pulling going on. It seems to be akin to a kind of competition to who can create the largest pantheon of strangeness out there to keep people on their toes. But that one is a remarkable one, as you say, because the whole origin about the poor dog being chopped in half and then hastily rearranged wrongly. it just baffles me that these stories seem to be incredibly and wildly popular, though, didn't they?
Remember that after working all day, 12, 14 hours in the woods, the lumberjacks would come back to the bunkhouse, and that's where they would sit around and try to dry out their clothing, smoke their cigars, get their chewing tobacco, and they'd sit around and spin tall tales. And they would tell these stories, trying to outdo one another, of how fantastical and sensational they were. And no story was ever told the same way twice. And oftentimes a story wasn't even told from beginning to end because somebody would jump in and say, "Oh, you got that wrong. I actually worked with Paul up on the Onion River, and this is how the story really happened." So it was a way of outdoing one another of who could be the best storyteller. And I've often wished I could just go back in history and pop my head into the bunkhouse and listen to the storytelling at night. Although, fair warning, the bunkhouse usually didn't have any windows, and it would house like 30 wet men who haven't bathed in months, smoking their tobacco, their pipes, and you know, putting their wet wool clothing by the fire, the smell would have probably knocked you out when you walked in, but it'd still be worth it to collect some of these stories.
Yeah, that's certainly a very interesting environment to find yourself in, I suggest.
And it really shows the cleverness of it again, that it was fun, but yet almost believable. You could almost believe that he sold that, especially in those times that he sold up a dog and it was just a mistake. Accidents happen, and that he turned it into a benefit of his. Same way where Paul was an avid outdoorsman, and it was said that he was such a good shot that he could shoot ducks that were so high in the sky that when he shot them, they spoiled before they even got down to the planet because they were so high up that in that amount of time, the meat had already spoiled.
Brilliant. Brilliant. There's nothing that this gentleman seems to be unable to do, Che.
And that really was, because a lot of these lumberjacks prided themselves on their creativity. That obviously back then, when you're working in the wilds of the North Woods, you'd have to be very creative to fix your tools, to figure out problems without modern technology or the internet to Google it and see how you're supposed to do it. So they prided themselves on their intelligence, although most of them were not educated formally. They had what we would consider street smarts, or back then, wood smarts.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of these stories as well have a kind of fable and warning to them in regards to keeping people aware of the dangers that... Because at the end of the day, we're talking about gentlemen working in the dead of winter, long hours. I mean, that's the other thing you mention as well in the book, Chad. It was highly dangerous work. A lot of these people who came to work there for the autumn and the winter seasons through terrible weather, you know, as you were saying, guys sitting around all day in wet clothes, sitting around together at night in a cramped conditions. These were dangerous times for these people, and there would be all kinds of issues in regards to illness and fatalities that could occur, because, you know, you're talking about people wielding heavy axes and giant trees falling about all over the place. This was not the employment choice of someone who may be faint-hearted, I would suggest.
Well, they worked from what they called can't see to can't see, where they would be up and in the woods before it got light, and they wouldn't get back to the bunkhouse until after it got dark. So they were working from can't see to can't see. And it was the most dangerous occupation in the U.S. And oftentimes these men prided themselves on being hard workers, that there were a lot of unofficial competitions in the lumber camps of who could cut the most that day, that week, that month, that season. And it wasn't for better pay. It was merely for bragging rights. And keep in mind, we think of these lumberjacks as these hulking barbarians, where back in the 1800s, even early 1900s, most of them would have been about 5 feet, 4 inches tall, maybe 150 pounds, but they could work nonstop. And the lumber camps really were ahead of their time, where they offered equal pay for equal work. That no matter your religion, where you came from, your skin color, if you could do the job like somebody else, you were paid the same way. And a lot of the camps were filled with immigrants, where the old joke is that on any given night at the bunkhouse, you could hear men snoring in 10 different languages.
Well, I suppose that would probably be one of the biggest enticements for a lot of people at that period, Chad, is that it was equal pay for equal work. And a lot of people just didn't have that opportunity at all. They were ostracized completely. So I'm not surprised that it would attract people from all over, not just the US and Canada. I would imagine that obviously a lot of people who were coming to North America at that time in the country's history would be coming primarily because they'd heard about these places where they could go and earn a lot of money for as long as they worked hard.
And they did. They made a lot of money. They were paid really well, and there was nothing to do there to spend it. So you either saved it up the entire season, and then either you were in one of two camps. You'd then go home, because most of these men were farmers. logging was done in the winter for several reasons. One, obviously, less bugs, mosquitoes, wood ticks, but also they could use the snow and ice to make trails down to the river with the horses and their logs. So they could haul these huge sleighs of logs down to the river, put them there, and then when the spring thaw came, it would raise up the rivers and they could put the logs in the rivers and shoot them down to the lumber towns where it would be cut up and then shipped all over the world. So a lot of these men would either take their money home with them and use it to good uses, or they would head to the nearest lumber town and spend it all in about a week on women, whiskey, gambling, not in that order, of course, but they would get rid of it and then wait for the next season and go do it all over again.
The temptations of having some money in your pocket.
And again, these were strong, sturdy men where if we mentioned about how dangerous it was, if they were injured out in the woods away from the camp, they would simply put a plug of tobacco in their cuts and wrap it up until they got back to the camp. And then hopefully somebody who wasn't too shaky in their hands could sew them together. And when they died, a lot of them died along the riverbanks that were getting the wood ready to go to the lumber mills. And oftentimes they would simply be buried where they died, either in a barrel, or if they were lucky, they'd have two slabs of wood that would be used as a makeshift coffin. And they would then nail their boots to a tree, signifying that there was a dead lumberjack there. And many times, some people didn't even know their real names. You might be known as Madison Mike or, you know, Slim Willie, where you wouldn't even have a real name. And so they wouldn't notify your next of kin or your family. You were just gone.
It's remarkable, really, that kind of situation. And like you say, unless you look at it, really, I suppose you don't realize that there would be a lot of people there who nobody would know where they were from, who they were, what their real names were. I suppose it's quite sad in a way that these people would simply come there to earn some money, and unfortunately a lot of them never came back.
Many of them would travel from one camp to another, and believe it or not, the most important thing at a camp was not the work conditions, not the cleanliness if there were less fleas and lice at the camp. It was how good the cook was. That's where they would go, because they ate and they needed to eat to work that brutal of conditions. And one of the reasons why when they went for breakfast in the cook shanty, that talking was not allowed at breakfast, because if you were talking, you were not eating. And if you were not eating, you would not have the calories needed to work the entire day. So they would just have never-ending supplies of food where they could just eat as much as they wanted, and that would go with their tobacco and their smoking and their coffee. And that's what they survived on, you know, tobacco, coffee, and endless amounts of food.
Oh, it's remarkable. It really is. I suppose one of the creatures, I would suspect that this creature, Chad, is probably the one that most people would know outside of this kind of niche of folklore, and that's the jackalope. I've seen this bobbing about for years. I've seen alleged real versions of the jackalope in display cases and online, and people seeing them in certain fortune and weird museums around the States. So for you, would you think that this is probably the one that's broken out of this kind of pool of strange creatures to become the star of these legends?
Without a doubt, the most ubiquitous of the lumberjack creatures is that of the jackalope. And you're right. If you've ever been to a tourist shop on a roadside attraction, you've seen them. They look by all means as a normal rabbit or hare would, but instead they're a little bit larger and they have these deer antlers on them. And the idea was that they were a combination of a jackrabbit and an antelope. But even though they don't have an antelope's horns, they have the antlers of a deer, or even in some instances more of like an elk. and they were thought to roam not only the prairies of the Southwest in America, where cowboys and ranchers would often hear them while they sat around the fire. They would hear the jackalopes singing along to their cowboy songs they would sing around the fire. But in the lumber camps, they would hear the jackalopes humming to the saws going back and forth and mimicking human talk. So the lumberjacks reported these jackalopes as much as the ranchers and cowboys out west did as well.
I did like it that certain people would suggest that the jackalope had favorite songs as well. That if you wanted to see one of these incredibly rare creatures, it seemed to have a couple of favorites, which I think was Home on the Range was one of them.
Yes, if you're going to try to attract a jackalope, there are two main ways in which you can do it. One, you can sing the old cowboy songs, the classics. Get along, little doggy, home on the range. Ain't nothing new. Don't sing anything new. Also, it was said that the jackalope was attracted to spirits, to liquor, specifically whiskey. And so much so that people would use it to bait them in, and they'd get so drunk that they could shoot the jackalope because the jackalope would be unable to run away. Apparently, it was such a disadvantage that most places outlawed giving jackalopes any booze because it was too unfair. It was just too easy to capture them. There was no sport in it. And to this day, it is said that they will try to sneak some spirits away from tourists.
I do like the fact that as well that the jackalope was supposed to get wise to this trick as well. And eventually they decided that they were all going to stop drinking, which is one of these things about the jackalope. Until I really read your chapter on it, Chad, I wasn't aware of these little nuances, like people claiming that it sang along or hummed along with things and its love of alcohol. And then the fact that they decided that they'd got wise to this trick and therefore they enjoyed the smell, but they all decided that they didn't want to drink it anymore.
Out of self-preservation, they kind of gave themselves a self-imposed prohibition where they stopped. They were, again, it was showing their intelligence. And what's interesting about the jackalope is not only does it look magnificent, like a really super cool creature you'd want to run into, but unlike a lot of these other creatures, it wasn't thought to be dangerous or deadly or fearsome, or even that it inhabited ill will against the humans, where a lot of these creatures did. They were upset with the humans coming in and clear cutting their land, their homes, because this was at a time, remember, when there was no environmental movement. They didn't cut a bunch, leave the rest, and replant everything. They cut everything whatsoever, all of it gone, just like a bomb blew it up. So a lot of these animals were thought to be resentful to humans for taking their land. But the jackalope seems more playful, spontaneous, and fun.
Yeah. Why do you think the jackalope seems to have become so popular, Chad? Do you think it is because it does look rather cute with its antlers? It's essentially an antlered rabbit, is the easiest description of it, regardless of its strange talents and intelligence. Do you think that that's why it seems to have leapt out of this pool of other creatures to become so well known?
Not only is it cute and cuddly, again, I'd love to have some in my backyard with its look, but it also is perhaps one of the more believable creatures out there. As weird as that seems, there are rabbits who develop a virus that causes these weird bone growths on the top of their heads. But those look more like they're out of Dr. Frankenstein's lab than beautiful antlers. So I think that they look kind of believable. Like, you could kind of see that animal existing compared to some of these other monsters. And then also, they just look super cool. And I think they make a great addition to the legend that kids love them. They buy fake jackalopes or banks, jackalope savings banks that you can put your coins into and all of that. And when they first started producing the jackalope, what they were doing is actually putting antlers on a real dead rabbit. And the orders for them were so plentiful they couldn't keep up. And they said, we're on to something here. This jackalope, people love it.
It is a great creature. Like you say, I think you're probably right there that it, out of all these wonderful creatures that exist in these tall tales and stories from that period, the jackalope is probably the most believable. And I would imagine, I would suggest that some people have probably said that because of that virus, that's what caused the legend to start in the first place. But then you think of all the other bits to it, Chad, where they, you know, you've got this ability to be attracted by singing, or the fact that some people claim that it could run up to 90 miles an hour.
It could run as fast as it really wanted, so fast that you might not even see it. And that's where, again, luring it in with liquor came to your advantage, because if you were hunting one of these things, that you'd have no chance to get it unless you evened out the playing field a little bit.
Yeah. And I think another one that I've got a real soft spot through reading your book, it's probably my favorite, I have to say, and that's the hoogag. I was very taken by this strange moose-like creature, and it seems quite a harmless creature through no fault of its own. So for anybody who's unaware of this marvelously interesting creature, what is the hoogag, Chad?
Paul, I really wanted to interrupt you there when you said my favorite creature, because I knew it was coming. The feedback I received from people, the overwhelming majority of people are attracted to the hoogag. And for those who have never heard of it or had the pleasure of encountering one in the woods, it looks like a moose by general physical dimensions. But instead of just having a regular mouth, its lips hang all the way down to the floor, and that it's got like a furless type back. If you wanted to maybe equate it with something, maybe Snuffleupagus from the old Sesame Street shows,
yeah,
where it looks like that. It's kind of this kind of slow laboring creature. All the newspapers of the 18 and early 1900s said it was dim-witted, of low intelligence, that it was harmless, it would make a good pet. But it would just scour the floors of the forest looking for stuff to eat and grab stuff off of trees, the bark, and just chew it off. But the problem was that its legs, it didn't have any knees, so it couldn't bend its legs. So all it could do is goose step its way through the forest, which meant it couldn't lie down to sleep because it wouldn't be able to get back up. And hunters took advantage of this when they found out that's exactly its weakness, because in order to sleep, it would have to lean against a tree all night and put its substantial weight against the tree. So what the lumberjacks and hunters would do is cut the trees halfway through. So when the hoogag came up to them, they would lean against them, knock it over, and fall down, and they wouldn't be able to get up so the hunters could shoot them. Plus, they were doing half of the lumberjack's work by knocking over the trees for them.
And it is also quite sad as well, because obviously if these poor unfortunate creatures fell over, they would basically be unable to get back up, and they would either become prey to a couple of the other more fearsome and ferocious lumberjack creatures that inhabited the woods at that time. Or occasionally lumberjacks may even feel sorry for them and right them.
Yes, they would. And what's interesting is that the forests often have telltale signs of the hoogag. And that is that the trees will be slanted from where they sleep at night. And a lot of people will see all these downed trees and think it was a tornado or a storm that knocked all these trees over, not knowing it was just the weight of the hoogag leaning up against them.
And I love that there was an article in the 1970s that took a humorous approach to the history of the hoogag, that basically prescribed it some hobbies, that it loved nothing better than to sniff flowers and splash about in lakes.
Again, it goes back to that idea that this is just a harmless creature. if you could afford to feed it, it would make a great pet, or even you maybe could ride it around the forest. And it just shows the entire spectrum of these creatures, from the really deadly and ferocious ones you didn't want to see to the ones where you really wish they were wandering around your local forest.
Yeah, they are remarkable, and I love the fact that they just seem to be these gentle giants that wander about. But also the fact that you mention as well is that you can hear them coming because they've got no knees. They goose-step everywhere, but they can also goose-step rather quickly. So most people, as you say, when we were talking about how to trap one, they had to use the tree technique, because most people couldn't keep up with them because they would travel at such a locomotion.
And remember, they're large, you know, 8 feet at the height, so they can take big steps. And it was said that even the best trackers could not keep up with them. So if you wanted to catch one or to kill it, you'd have no other choice but to start cutting trees, mostly so they would fall on them. And it was said they always like to lean on the northern trees for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, and you get those little tidbits that makes no sense. Why would you come up with that? What's it matter what direction they like leaning on the trees? But that has become ingrained in the folklore.
Yeah, a lot of them have these little nuances. And it's interesting that they, when they were in this environment working and living, Chad, clearly that they seem to prescribe certain natural phenomenon to certain creatures.
You would have to explain away things that would happen when you were in the camp. So at night, when blizzards ravaged the woods, you'd have to explain those sounds of trees cracking and the wind whipping through, that it couldn't just be the weather. You'd have to tell the rookies, or the greenhorns, as they were known, of these fantastical beings that were responsible for all this. Because remember, in those days, the forests, they seemed endless.
Mm.
They seemed inexhaustible, that there could be anything living in the woods. They had no idea what might be lurking out there. So that was part of the fun, is they never knew when they were going deeper and deeper what they might encounter.
And speaking of what you may encounter, one of the creatures I was really looking forward to reading about when we last spoke, and you told me that you were working on this book for your next release, was one that, as soon as you told me what it was called, I thought, I really need to know more about that. And this is the Hide Behind, which is one of those wonderful creatures that kind of explains that whenever you're out walking somewhere in the woods and you feel suddenly that something or someone is watching you, then probably you are being stalked by a Hide Behind.
I think all of us have had that experience when you're on a trail or in the woods, when you might start to look over your shoulder a couple times and hoping that maybe it's a fellow hiker coming up behind you, passing by you. But no, it's the Hide Behind. And I included a drawing of it in the book, a depiction of it. But in truth, it is said that nobody's ever seen it, that they've seen the general outline. But the Hide Behind, as its name implies, will hide behind you when you're standing in the woods. It will be directly behind you. If you jump 180 degrees, it will still be directly behind you. And that it is so good at hiding behind trees, rocks, and other things that it has evolved so much that it can actually hide behind itself.
Yeah, and it is interesting that obviously there are plenty of creatures in the book that these lumberjacks seem to be aware of or would warn people about, and they all had certain strange things. But reading your chapter, it seems that the Hide Behind seem to be the most feared or the most notorious for people working out on their own or being in the woods without any kind of support with them, Chad. They were at real danger of being taken by the Hide Behind.
The Hide Behind would sneak up behind you and grab you and take you off to its lair, where it would eat you, of course. And I think it just goes back to our fear of what's out there in the woods. And when you're in the woods, you're surrounded 360 degrees of things that could come after you. So that vulnerability of having your back to somewhere that's open gave a lot of lumberjacks pause, because And maybe it sprang up from the idea of the, you know, cougars and panthers and that attacking from behind. That you always kind of had to keep one eye over your shoulder to make sure the hide behind wasn't coming after you or anything else for that matter.
Yeah. Well, once again, it does seem to be that, because you would suggest that, once again, this is a tale where it's keeping the greenhorns on their toes and making sure that they do keep looking behind them, that they are aware of what's happening, that they do make sure that they don't face one direction for too long, Chad, because, as you say, you don't know what could be creeping up behind you.
The woods was a very dangerous place. Not only did they have to contend with these lumberjack fearsome creatures, they had to contend with known creatures of bears, moose, elk, rattlesnakes, all kinds of other things that would be happy to be putting you in the grave. So I think it was kind of, you had to have all your senses heightened at the time, because not only was the work dangerous, the work atmosphere, the location was dangerous too.
And obviously one of the strangest things is, unlike the jackalope, the best way to stop or dispel a hide behind is the smell of alcohol. Apparently they didn't like it at all, and it was always a surefire way to keep yourself safe was to make sure you either had some or you smelt of it.
And that wasn't a problem for a lot of people in the Northwoods of that time. And I'm fascinated by how much alcohol and spirits kind of wiggled their way into this folklore, because it was, and for a lot of people still today, is a big part of their lives. And I think that only makes sense that it would be incorporated into the legends, because it was part of everyday living. Although most lumber camps did not allow drinking or beverages of adult beverages or spirits, because it just caused too many problems, that they didn't allow it in their camps. But outside of the camps, in the woods, and when they're done, obviously people were free to imbibe any way they wanted, and they took that to extremes.
Well, to be fair, if the hide behind's lurking about, I don't blame them.
Yeah, you need that to calm the nerves, I think. And again, those stories even took on their own life. There's a funny story of how a man bought some whiskey from a local bar, and he bought it when he was heading in. So it was at the end of summer, and he bought it to bring up to the lumber camp for Christmas. So he buried it out in the woods and waited until Christmas and broke it out on Christmas, and everybody had a drink, and it was spoiled. It was terrible whiskey. And when spring came about, he went back to the bar and he complained. He said, "I bought this. I was using it for Christmas and it went bad. You need to give me my money back." And the quick-witted bartender said, "Oh, I'm sorry. You bought summer whiskey. I didn't know you wanted winter whiskey. You should have told me it was for Christmas." And of course, the lumberjack could do nothing but leave. He had been outsmarted by the bartender.
Oh, that's a fantastic excuse. Brilliant.
And those were just circulated all over. And in those days, if somebody outsmarted you, you thought it was fun. You thought it was interesting. Much like when P.T. Barnum later would have exits all over with signs saying, "Check this out." And people would leave the museum on an exit. And instead of being mad that they have to come back and pay again, they thought it was clever. Oh, P.T. Barnum always outwitting people.
Well, talking about outwitting people, Chad, I think the last creature we should touch on is probably another one, along with the jackalope, that probably some people will have heard of, primarily because this one seemed to really catch fire at the end of the 19th century and start appearing all over newspapers. And I know a gentleman called Eugene Shepherd is synonymous with this creature, and that's the Hodag.
You're absolutely right, and there are many cities in America that fight over being the home of the Hodag. And the Hodag looks like some prehistoric dragon-like creature. It has spikes down its back. It has horns. It looks like a giant lizard with tusks. Normally, they're dark-colored, brown, green, black, even a dark gray. And Eugene Shepherd was this timber cruiser up in the Rhinelander, Wisconsin area. And a timber cruiser was someone who would go out to the woods and mark it up and show how much wood might be there for the lumber companies so they could bid on this property and know what to expect. They were well paid and very well trained. And Eugene Shepherd, by all counts, was this huckster that he loved a tall tale. Some say that he even created the legend of Paul Bunyan. And if he didn't create it, he was one of the first tellers of Paul Bunyan legends. And he was an amazing storyteller. And back in 1893, he claimed that he had seen one of these hodags out in the woods. So he gathered a posse together, and apparently they went out and caught one of these things. And they put it on display at carnivals and county fairs, circuses, and people would pay to come into the tent where the hodag would be in there. And right before they were about to release it, one of the workers would come in making a racket, screaming, saying, "The hodag's loose. Everybody get out." And of course, nobody would see it then because they'd all scatter the tent. And then the next show would start in 15 minutes.
It's also one of the few creatures in the book that seems to have a supernatural origin as well, because I think people would say that hodags were created from the spirits of slain oxen, which is one of those things that once again falls into this kernel of truth in its origin story, Chad, that obviously when these guys left camp after the end of the winter, they would tend to leave their oxen and things there, wouldn't they? So when they returned, the oxen were no more, and obviously they'd all become hodags.
There were two ways that an ox could turn into a hodag. As you said, the oxen that were left behind, when you came back the following fall, they would have turned into a hodag. But also they were used in the lumber industry, where horses were used to pull the sleighs, but they loved the oxen because they didn't need a specific diet. They didn't need to be tended to like horses with the shoeing and all the pampering and the combing and care that a horse took, where they would use the oxen. But as you can imagine, a lot of these creatures had very hard lives. They were treated badly by the lumberjacks, and they were physically used until they were put down. So it was said that as soon as they died, they would have such a warped spirit that they would turn into the hodag. And there was perhaps no other creature that was more feared in the lumberjack world than that of the hodag, because it was said that every year dozens of lumberjacks would lose their lives to the hodag attack.
It what certainly seems to be a very fearsome creature. And once again, as we mentioned the hoogag earlier, this was one of the predators that would attack hoogags if it found them that when they'd fallen over. So it is strange how this one seems to have developed this real ferocity, because essentially it was said to eat anything. But I found it very interesting. One of these, once again, these little nuances to these stories, Chad, is that why does the hogag get associated with having a taste for white bulldogs?
This is another one of those inexplicable stories of folklore.
Yeah.
Bulldogs, especially white ones at that time, were extremely rare as they are today. And to take it even further, some legends tell that it would only eat white bulldogs on Sundays. So the rest of the week, these dogs could relax and take it easy, only be on their best behavior on Sundays. But again, where that came from, I never found out why that's specific. I think what it was is probably that it was just rare enough to make sense that you could believe it, because if it said it ate, you know, brown dogs, everyone has a brown dog and they're cuddly, and that, you know, that doesn't make sense. There'd be no dogs left. It's like when you play the yellow car game, where when you see a yellow car or truck or vehicle, you have to shout out "yellow car," and there's just enough yellow cars to make it fun, where there's not too many, but there's not where you're going to go 4 hours without seeing one. So I think the same thing applied to the bulldogs, that it was just rare enough to make sense. Do you play yellow car over there?
Yeah. We used to play, you know, you would sometimes do that, and people would always... I mean, it is one of those things that makes me laugh as a child, Chad. Whenever we went on car trips anywhere, you know, because obviously any traveling anywhere for more than 3 hours in the UK is, you know, a hell of a journey, whereas in the States, that's usually, you know, a round trip to work. So you would often play that kind of game, and it's quite funny looking back when we were kids, choosing, say, silver would be really rare, whereas now, you know, silver cars are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it is odd how things like that change, because yet yellow is still quite a rare colour. So you would still, like you say, you wouldn't go that long, but you would have to work to spot them.
And I think it's evidence, and you and I have talked on this on your show, and before we end, too, let me just say that congratulations on the success of this show. Everywhere I turn, people are raving about either listening to it or being on it or loving it. So congrats there. And
thank you, Chad.
But it's evidence that you and I have talked in the past quite a bit about how, at least on my end, quite a bit, I believe that folklore, these legends, they're always growing. They're always changing. That most people think of folklore in a boring way, that you're studying the old pots and pans and all kinds of quilts of these old cultures, where for me, it's always a living thing. It's always changing. And your example of how it might have went from silver cars that were rare back then, but today you couldn't play that game.
Yeah.
And the folklore is changing, where today maybe white bulldogs aren't quite what the hodag likes to eat. Who knows?
Yeah, I would imagine maybe these days it could have a bit more of a speciality taste. So yeah, that would be interesting. It is, like you say about folklore, I think that's one of the things I've learned to appreciate doing this show and learning more about the legends in my particular area as well, Chad, because where I live, I'm very fortunate to be close to an area rich in folklore history, which is the Peak District. And it's got stories of, you know, a mermaid that lives in a little lake up there, and boggarts and hobbits and gnomes and ghosts and screaming skulls. And it's one of those things that often I don't think we appreciate what's on our doorstep. And often we cast our eyes to foreign shores or to further flung fields looking for these wonderful monsters and creatures when, as Linda Godfrey once famously said, you know, always start investigating on your doorstep because you never know what you might find.
I think that nails it on the head. Once again, Linda's completely correct there. And it's like the old example that if you rent a cabin on a lake, the first thing you do if you're going fishing or recreation is you get in the boat and you leave where you're at, where the fishing could be the best off of your dock, but yet you're going to go try it over here. You're going to travel. So I think there is so much in our own backyards. And I think that if anything good of this pandemic has come out, it's forced people to explore what's in their own neighborhoods and maybe appreciate what's surrounding them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a little wander the other day up to my, through my local park. We've got a wonderful building there, Chad, called the Bishop's House, which is from the 15th century.
Wow.
And it's literally a mile walk.
And you're lucky there because Europe, you talk about legends in hundreds of years.
Mm.
In the U.S., we talk about legends in decades.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We are spoiled for choice in that regard, I must admit.
So if these legends are morphing and progressing and moving and always changing, that, you know, 300 years of change, you're going to get a lot of differences than 28 years of change.
Yeah, very much so. Well, it's still a malleable thing, isn't it? It'd be interesting to see where some of these stories end up in 20, 30 years time as well, I suspect.
And an important part of this is that at some point it becomes the legend, where a lot of people will contact me and complain that media has, I don't know, changed the certain legends in folklore, usually about cryptids, that they'll look a certain way now that they never used to look. And for instance, when we did the Wendigo episode on your show, we talked about how they now have antlers
yes.
in all the depictions and they never used to. But perhaps that the legends themselves change. But if these cryptids, these monsters, these creatures are real, perhaps they're evolving as well, where it doesn't matter when the antler started appearing. That's what it's become today. So for all intents and purposes, antlers are part of the Wendigo now.
Yeah, I suppose the Chupacabra is another great example of that, from where it started as to where it's become.
Yeah, the early, you know, Central America, South America, Puerto Rico ones where, as you know, they were more of your 4-foot Sonic the Hedgehog bipeds with spikes running down their back. And now you have more of like the Texas Southwestern chupacabras that are four-legged, you know, looking like coyotes with mange.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. No, that's a very good point then. So before I let you go, Chad, what's next? Have you got plans to hunt down any new monsters, or have you got anything in the pipeline we should start getting excited about?
Well, I'm always doing my traditional ghosts, monsters, UFOs of certain states, and I'm working on those. But the Lumberjack Creatures and a few other books I've done are more of the monograph type, where they're smaller, less than 100 pages, cheaper price, and meant for tourists to pick them up, people that I'm not speaking to the choir about. And I really love that, because there are so many things that need a book, but they wouldn't fill a full-size book. It would just be too much filler and just not enough. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
But these little monographs. So right now I'm working on, for next winter, I've been doing a lot of lectures on legends and folklore of winter.
Mm.
And I'm going to put that together as a monograph. And that's everything from Krampus, the anti-Santa Claus, to superstitions about New Year's Eve, to having to open your door at midnight on Christmas Eve so you can let Christmas into your house.
Yep.
Otherwise, you'll have a horrible Christmas.
Yep.
All those things about how if you're born on a certain dates in the winter, you might be more likely to turn into a werewolf. Yes. So I'm putting all of those legends and folklore together in another little monograph.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, we've got some very strange traditions. It's New Year's Eve here for us at that period, where at midnight you have to leave the house and a man has to come with a piece of coal, Chad, and knock on the door to be allowed in to guarantee you a good New Year.
Do you have people who do that for a payment that'll go house to house?
They used to. It's one of those traditions that's kind of dropped out of fashion, sadly. But I've still got a couple of ornaments that belong to my grandfather that he had. So I will always still use that. So I will always nip outside and just knock on the door holding one of these ornaments made out of coal.
And I don't know if it's the same over in the UK, but here in America, these old legends, as evidenced by the explosion of the popularity of Krampus, that people are craving these old legends. They're making a big comeback, these superstitions, these beliefs here in the U.S. I don't know if it's the same way over there, but here it's crazy.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. I think a lot of that's to do with it's kind of skipped a generation or two, Chad. And I think some people are looking backwards to kind of capture that innocence and that happiness that a lot of us kind of look back to when we were, you know, growing up as children and the, you know, the silly little things we used to do at that period of time and different times of the year. And I think it's giving people a bit of a trip down memory lane, but also really reconnecting with tradition and folklore and their past. And I think it is interesting that the internet, I think, is helping kind of popularize things that for a lot of people, they probably were unaware of. So I think it's a good time to be open-minded and interested in the history of folklore, and long may these traditions continue to regain popularity.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it shows that these legends, the folklore, they're not just stories. They're the fabric of our communities, the fabric of our cultures, and that's what keeps us together and, you know, makes it interesting. And I'm with you. I hope these legends continue to gain in popularity.
Yeah. So, Chad, as always, thank you so much for your conversation. Where can everybody keep up to date and get a copy of your wonderful collection of Lumberjack stories, as well as following your upcoming adventures?
Of course, you can just go online, find me everywhere. Or I always like to say that find the weirdest location you've ever heard of, and most likely that's where you'll find me.
Nothing wrong with that, my friend. Nothing wrong with that. As always, my friend, it's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you. Hopefully we will always find time to speak further down the line. And I look forward to your next publication. That sounds like something that will be a terrific read. And I wish you the very best for the upcoming winter season. You stay safe out there.
Keep an eye out.